Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge.
Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast. My name is Tiagi Delanerol, and I'm your host today. Today, I'm joined by Michelle Grohalski, CEO and founder of Empowered EDI. We're speaking about turning equity into action, rewiring systems to truly include everyone. So Michelle is a global equity strategist and the founder of Empowered EDI, a consulting firm redefining how organizations approach equity, diversity, and inclusion. With two decades of experience and international accolades, including Canada's Top 100, and a distinction for progressing gender equality across Canadian corporations, Michelle is known for moving EDI beyond performative talk and into systematic transformation. Her work focuses on changing the way people's decisions are ultimately made, from advising Fortune 500 firms and not-for-profits to leading global strategy at BlackBerry and BMO. She's helped shape cultures where equity is not just an afterthought, but a foundational operating principle. Michelle's philosophy, "Lift as you rise," is more than a tagline. It's leadership lens that informs how she coaches, consults, and shows up in the world. So in this episode, we'll explore how to embed equity into decision-making systems, not just in values, but in practice, why metrics matter, and which ones actually drive change, and what it takes to build workplaces where everyone can thrive, not just survive. Welcome, Michelle.
Great to be here.
Fantastic. So here at the Employee Wellbeing Council, we really pride ourselves on focusing on the human, and we're going to focus in on you now by asking two Proust-inspired questions. The very first one is, which talent would you most like to have?
I wish that I had the power to pause time, and in particular, to pause that moment before a person jumps to a conclusion about someone else. What I'd like to do is I'd like to stop time so that they can be a little bit more open-minded and compassionate without jumping to judgment, so that we can see people for who we actually are, as opposed to stereotypes or these really narrow definitions of who we think is trustworthy or competent or likable, for example. So yeah, so for me, it's about pausing time so that we can all live in a world that's just a little bit more empathetic.
I love that. That is so human-centric and such a kind of an X-ray capability, which I think is so interesting. Very first one that I've heard. So thank you for sharing that. And if you were to die and come back as a person or a thing, what would it be?
This was a hard one. This was a tough one. But ultimately, I would come back as Maya Angelou. She is such an incredible, she's an incredibly wise human being that just brings a depth of humanity to her work and to her words. She has this ability just to speak truth to power, but in a way that it doesn't shame, it doesn't blame anybody, it doesn't belittle anyone. Instead, she inspires people to be their best selves. And it's always moved me. She calls people in with grace, and that's something that I've tried to do within my own work. We have so much to learn when it comes to other people's circumstances and what might shape who they are and how they show up at work. And if we can just have that grace and that empathy and perspective for one another, as Maya Angelou calls us to do, I think we would have much more of a high performing, but also a thriving workplace centered on wellness, which I know is so core to you and to your listeners.
Yes, absolutely. I knew why I liked you so much. Right. And this just fortifies it that much more. I love that response. Maya Angelou, in my opinion, is like she's like an angel on earth that really ultimately helped us learn a deeper side of our humanity. So you're right on the money. I think that's a fantastic person to aspire to come back in life as.
I agree. So, and then being friends with Oprah, icing on the cake, right?
Right, exactly. Oh my God, don't even get me started on Oprah. Like, I loved watching her growing up. She really, like, she was able to bring out so many different perspectives. And it was, I think, I think it was also core to, like, really diversity and inclusion, even back in the 90s, right? And the early 2000s when she really started to take off.
Absolutely. So
let's get into your work a little bit. Let's focus on rewiring people and systems for equity. You often talk about equity being rooted in how, not just the why. What are some of the hidden ways traditional systems unintentionally reinforce bias, and how can organizations dismantle those?
Equity is so misunderstood right now. And so I'm grateful that you have chosen to ask me this question, because certainly it does live in the how. It's about how we make decisions about people on a daily basis. Not only who we hire, but also who gets development opportunities, who gets promoted, how we pay people, how we give people performance reviews or the kinds of ratings we ascribe to them. And the issue that I solve for is that many of those decisions are subjective. A lot of them rely on gut feelings that people have, or very subjective and very fuzzy concepts like culture fit or professionalism. Many of these decisions, they favor people who are very vocal or people who are quite visible. So maybe people who work alongside their boss in a physical workspace as opposed to remotely or at a different location. And those biases, what ends up happening is that they shape who gets opportunity and who ends up leading our organizations, not because those people are the most capable or because they are have the greatest potential, but because they mirror a lot of our assumptions around who we think a good leader is. So lots of examples of this, but let me kind of give you a couple.
Yeah.
One is around succession planning. I was working with a group of executives, and they were developing their succession plate for all of the executive roles within this large multinational organization. And what became apparent through their conversation was that they had a preference for extroverts. They would say things like, you know, I think this person could be a great leader as long as they get over their shyness, as long as they, you know, can become a little bit more bold in the room. And I would ask them questions around, well, you know, why is that important? What is that linked to? So a person who, for example, might hold their opinions back and listen to the viewpoints of others before weighing in, how does that negatively impact their ability to meet the requirements of the job? And when we started discussing it, what we learned was, in fact, there's no correlation there. And in fact, many of the leaders around that table, C-suite executives, are introverts themselves. And many of them have felt pressure to try to be more extroverted in order to live up to this kind of invisible example, or this invisible, what would you call that? This invisible standard for what a good leader looks like. And so when we started discussing it, they realized, actually, no, this is not a criteria on which we want to make decisions. We're going to remove that from consideration. Extroversion is not important to us. So let's talk about the requirements for the role. So that's just one example of how often these decisions are not as robust and evidence-based. This is shocking for a lot of people. You know, many people have not necessarily looked under the hood, so to speak, of how decisions get made inside of organizations. But I've got almost, you know, two decades of doing this. And I can tell you that the majority of these kinds of decisions are woefully ambiguous. If you were to take a look at how marketing decisions get made or sales strategy gets done within an organization, you would see that there's very clear parameters, right? This is how we know that we've been successful. This is how we know if we are going to reinvest in this, or here's how we know that these efforts have paid off. You don't have that same degree of rigor, of documentation, of clarity when it comes to how we evaluate the success of our people. So equity is about, let's get clear. Let's make sure that when we're making decisions, we can defend them because we have clear expectations, clear standards. We know what our objectives are and our criteria. And we are ensuring that those decisions that we're making are based on that criteria and not on things like, they just had a good vibe.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I'm so glad you are, like, you're doing the work you're doing and you're in some of these rooms. Like, obviously, you're one human being and you can only be in so many rooms. But thank God you are in the rooms that you are in, because just even asking the question, right, and helping them kind of unpack, like, why, like, what, the why, right? And, like, kind of getting to the root cause is important. And you're right. You're absolutely right in terms of, you know, things should be more equitable.
They really should. And many of us have had these experiences where we get a performance rating and we ask our manager, why? Why is it that I am meeting expectations or below expectations? Why aren't I exceeding? And many of us know what it feels like when the manager comes back and says, you're just not ready yet, you know, or you just didn't meet the bar. Well, what was the bar? Did we talk about it in advance? Were you clear and transparent with me around what great performance looked like? Did we measure it along the way so that you could tell me or that I could know if I was off track and that I could course correct? Have I been given feedback in order for me to learn and grow? It's just, you know, it's shocking. At the end of the year, many folks receive ratings that don't align with their own perceptions of how their performance has been over the year. And no one should be in that place. No one should be surprised. We should all have a clear indicator of how we're doing so that we can level up and that we can improve. And ultimately, that makes our organizations better. Our performance collectively is going to be much, much enhanced if all of us know how we're doing proactively and not just at the end of the year. So yes, let's get rid of ambiguity. Let's be clearer, more transparent. Let's make sure that this is not just about, you know, a statement on the wall saying that we care about fairness, but it's actually living in the daily mechanics of how we're making decisions.
I love that. I mean, I having also being a founder of Oot, I know that one of the things that I've learned, especially working with developers, is around sprint cycles and retrospectives and, like, making sure that there's, like, a continuous feedback loop. I'm wondering, you know, could things like A/B testing on certain decisions, like with results captured, so that you can optimize for succession planning, like using almost like a sprint cycle methodology. We should talk offline about that, but I think that would be very interesting because I think it would be more equitable and you'd have concrete data around it as well.
I think that's a great idea. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's talk offline. Okay. So in terms of equity work, this is deeply personal to you. And often it's also emotionally taxing. How do you balance empathy and endurance in such a demanding space? And how can leaders better support EDI practitioners?
You are so right. This work is deeply personal. For someone to decide to have a career in this space, they undoubtedly are bringing their own lived experiences of perhaps being treated unfairly, you know, to perhaps a marginalization or discrimination. You're not just a consultant, right? You're bringing with you the lens that of your lived experiences. So for me, you know, I'm a woman and I'm a mother, I'm a person with a disability, and I have a lot of lived experiences that helps to inform the work that I do. And that shapes my perception. So for me, I have to ensure that when I'm doing this work, I am surrounding myself with people who bring different lenses, people who can contribute and add perspectives that are different from mine, so that I'm continuously learning from them, so that I'm not looking at the ways in which I'm doing work or looking at clients through a biased perspective, but rather I'm opening my own vantage point as expansively as possible. And I'm very deliberate about carving out time to bring myself joy. One thing I do religiously. In fact, right before this discussion, I exercise every single day. I do that because so much of my work is focused on thinking and creating. I find it really cathartic to be able to just turn off my mind and tune into my body. You know, for me, I'm a long distance cyclist. So being on my bike outdoors, not in front of a screen, just focusing on my breathing and my heart is, you know, heartbeat is just so therapeutic. Plus I'm a mom of two kids. So I love that they're not, you know, tugging on my shirt.
You have some time alone.
Exactly. I don't have to feed snacks every hour. I read. I'm a voracious reader. I find it builds perspective and empathy. I have an opportunity to open pages and to dive into a world that is completely different from myself. It helps me to envision how other people might experience the world. And play. I love to play with my kids. I'm constantly playing board games with them. You know, playing kitchen restaurant with my kids. All that kind of. That kind of prioritization of self-care, I find, just helps me to decompress because the work can be really, really heavy. And then the other thing I would say that is helpful for me is I genuinely believe that humans are inherently good. And some of your listeners are going to roll their eyes at that because right now...
I think you're spot on. You're spot on and we should cultivate that, right?
Yeah. You know, right now you turn on the news and there's just so much evidence of what's going wrong in the world and things that we absolutely should be upset about. And I'm not excusing that. But I do believe that the majority of us are doing the best we can with what we know and what we have at the time. And this is going back to Maya Angelou. You know, when people know better, they do better. So yes, you know, there are people out there making terrible decisions and doing harm in this world. I do believe that a lot of those folks are doing that from a place of being wounded and hurt. Not that it justifies it, but I think it does bring a little bit of compassion and empathy to say when people feel hurt, they hurt other people. And so how do we as a collective create space to say, look, the way through this is not by discriminating against people. It's not about making other people, you know, the target of your blame. It's not about castigating others. If you're feeling threatened, if you're feeling like this is something that is scary, let's talk about that. You know, we saw this recently. A lot of people felt like my work, equity, diversity, and inclusion, was a threat to them. They felt like I'm going to lose my job as a white heterosexual man because of the work of EDI, when in fact, that's not what we're doing at all. You know, I often say I love white heterosexual men. I'm married to one. I'm a mother of a son. You know, I have no agenda to take opportunity away from anybody. In fact, all I'm looking to do is make sure that the best and most qualified people get the opportunity and that we're not discriminating against anyone. However, a lot of people felt afraid. They felt like they were going to lose something. So rather than pointing the finger at other people, you know, oh, racialized people are trying, they have an agenda to overthrow us or to take opportunities away. It's to say, that's not going to get you to a place where you're feeling secure. Belittling other people, all it's doing is creating more hostility, animosity, fear within yourself. So let's talk about it. You're feeling that way? All right. You know, let's look at the facts. Let's have a conversation. I think recognizing that a lot of people are striking because they feel vulnerable. They're striking out because they feel vulnerable. And realizing that we are not going to solve that by doing more of the same, by judging people, by, you know, blaming them, but instead by sitting down and having real conversations. We don't have to agree at the end of the day, but we do have to respect one another and say, I want to listen to your perspective. I want to seek to understand, and I want to roll up my sleeves and try to be a part of the solution, because each and every one of us deserves to be in a place where we feel peace and we feel like we are valued. So yeah, so I really do believe that people are inherently good. And I think that if we approach one another with that sincerity around, I care about you, I want to learn from you, let's have a conversation, I think that we can solve a lot of the conflict that we're experiencing today, not only out in the world, but inside of our very polarized workplaces.
I love that. I love the fact that you're shedding light on this, because I am very much of the same mind, right? I think So many misunderstandings can be solved by just breaking bread or sitting down, having a conversation, and then you can gain more clarity around things. So thank you for that. Along the same vein, right? When you think about belonging versus fitting in, there is a difference between truly being included, right? And having that sense of belonging. How do you design cultures of belonging that don't require people to code switch or shrink themselves to feel safe?
Yeah, belonging, what it means is that a person can be themselves and they are included. So you can be unique, you can be different, you don't have to be like everyone else, and you are part of something bigger. We care about your perspective. We're thinking about you and what can help to bring up the best for you and with you. You are a valued member of this community. In contrast, fitting in is about editing yourself in order to be accepted. And the analogy that I like to compare this to is, for me, high school.
Yeah.
Many of us, I mean, I'm kind of dating myself, all of its glory. Yep. I'm dating myself. But, you know, I think back to high school, we had these distinct groups, you know, back in the kind of 90s. You had the ones who were very academically oriented. You had the jocks, you know, you had the people who were really into like heavy metal. You know, you had the people who were more hipsters or preppies. And we often felt like we had to conform to one of those identities, even though most of us have aspects of all of that within ourselves. You know, so for me, I was very academically inclined, but I always loved rock music and metal. And on top of that, you know, I was working at an upscale woman's boutique, so I dressed pretty preppy. So like, where do you fit? Today's workplaces are very similar in that there's often unwritten rules around how a person should show up, how they should speak, how they should present themselves, how they should dress in order to be seen as a good fit within that culture. It might not be as visible as what we saw in high school, but I would say it's still as powerful as what many of us experienced at that time. You know, for an example, one organization that I was working with had a criteria in their performance review that people should not overshare personal details at work. So if a person was seen to share too many personal details, then they would receive a lower performance review than another person. Having that written down and having people evaluated on that was a signal to people that they had to be a certain way in order to fit into this organization and to be compensated like they wanted to or get access to development or opportunity. So what that meant is there were a lot of people who did not talk about their sexual orientation. They did not talk about infertility or adopting. They did not talk about the death of a loved one or a divorce from a spouse or maybe a chronic injury that they had or a disability. And if people are not willing to share that stuff with us, well, they are not bringing their true selves to the table. Imagine coming back to work on a Monday and people saying to you, "How was your weekend?" And you have to pause and think, okay, I can't tell them about the fact that I did a walk for MS because I have MS. I can't tell them about the fact that I went to, I celebrated a birthday of my partner who is of the same sex or gender identity as me. I can't tell them that I'm Muslim and I went to mosque. Like, imagine the amount of thought and energy that would be spent having to edit yourself in that way. And many of your listeners are nodding because they're doing it. They know what it feels like. And at the end of the day, like, what does that do? How does having that, let's say, criteria for performance reviews and for their culture, how does that help that company to be more successful? And I asked that of the leaders, okay, so this is the indicator. Talk to me about how this drives performance. How is this furthering your strategic plan? How does this, you know, help you to achieve the kind of culture you want to achieve? Honestly, they didn't know. They could not specify. It was just a legacy thing that was built that just got carried on year on year on year. And so what we did was we decided that, in fact, what they really wanted to uphold and to encourage was that people not share confidential information about client files. That was it. So if you're working on a client
file, amazing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, don't go tell your uncle about the client we're working with and, you know, their sensitive information. Great. So we got more precise. We embedded that into their performance reviews. That's embedded into their behaviors and their culture. And what that's doing is it's actually freeing people up to belong, to be included. So it's these kinds of hidden criterion that honestly force people to feel like they have to shrink, they have to hide, they have to edit themselves. Otherwise, they're going to get penalized inside of their organizations. And when that happens, well, we are missing out on the beauty and the authenticity that people will bring to work that makes it joyful and fun.
Yeah, that's so true. And, you know, it's so true. And it resonates, I know, with a number of employee well-being council members because they've said as much, right? This is something that's very important to many leaders as they're looking to really kind of like gain the most out of the talent. I think there's so many wonderful perspectives and creative ways of addressing things. And you can only do that if you have that psychological safety in place, right? To bring your full self. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna actually get into a little bit of the data side of things, right? Data to action, measuring what matters. You take a bit of an, well, not a bit, you take an analytics-based approach to EDI. What data do you believe is the most underused or misunderstood, and how do organizations use it to drive real change?
When people think about data as it relates to equity, diversity, and inclusion, they immediately think about representation data, which means who works in your organization, what are their demographics? For example, what are their ages? What are their racial backgrounds or ethnic backgrounds? What's the gender composition? And how does that compare to who is available in the market or in the community with which the organization operates? That data is important. It's important because it tells a company, are you tapping into the available talent pool? Or might there be something that's getting in the way of particular communities coming into your organization? For example, it could be that the language within your job descriptions is alienating some folks. It could be that you're posting the jobs in places where different communities don't go. For example, there was research that shows that when companies post jobs on places like LinkedIn, they're less likely to reach people from underrepresented communities than if they're posting it on something, a platform like Indeed. So those are the kinds of questions we want to ask. But we do that not because we're trying to force a quota. And that's really important. When done well, equity, diversity, and inclusion is not about forcing quotas. Instead, it's about asking ourselves, where might there be barriers that are preventing people who are qualified, who deserve opportunities, who deserve to be treated fairly, access to our organization? So once we know where there's gaps, we can fix it, right? We can figure out what we need to do better so that nobody is being discriminated against or nobody who's qualified and who deserves an opportunity is left behind. So that's what people think about. Love that. However, I would push us. We need to do way better with data. In particular, I love looking at internal workforce metrics. I'm curious about who is getting promoted inside of this company? Who's getting mentored? What are the pay ranges for people within similar roles? Are there discrepancies? For example, people with disabilities, are they getting paid less than people without disabilities for the same work? And the one that I love is performance ratings.
It's near and dear to your heart, but it's so important, right? Because it impacts your earning potential.
It does. Everything comes down to these performance ratings. Mm-hmm. And it's demoralizing. When you get a performance rating, as mentioned before, that doesn't reflect your contributions, it just, you're not going to show up and perform. You're not going to stay. You're going to phone it in. So I love looking at what's the distribution of how performance ratings are attributed or ascribed across different groups and where are their differences. I did this within one organization here in Canada. We saw that there was a gap between how men and women were being evaluated at the same level. And so many people think that the solution that I would recommend is to say, okay, everybody, there's a difference in how men and women are getting rated. Therefore, bump the women up. They should be the same. That's not what we did. Instead, what we said was, when we're doing performance calibration, which means managers come together and they talk about how they are evaluating their people to make sure they're on the same page. And they're also able to challenge one another, provide different perspectives, because often a manager only has one view of their talent. And by bringing different people together, we might get different experiences, different interpretations, different input that can help us be more open-minded and robust in our feedback. So what we did was we just added some debiasing questions. So is it that this woman didn't perform at this level, or is it that, for example, she just didn't brag about her accomplishments in her self-evaluation to the extent that maybe other people did? And just by asking those questions of what if, or is that a fact, or what additional evidence do we need, we were able to minimize the gap between men and women's performance ratings by 10%. So we didn't artificially inflate anything. We just asked questions to make sure that we are accurately assessing performance. So those kinds of metrics, I think, are not only important because they tell you where there's issues in your organization, but also by measuring that, we can go back to people and say, look, this is making a difference. EDI is not just a nice to have. By doing this work, we're in fact ensuring that everyone here is given a fair chance and evaluated based on their impact and contributions, not just our assumptions or biases.
Yeah, it's taking much more of like, I feel like a systematic approach, right? As opposed to just a gut feel approach, which is fantastic. Now, you've actually worked in some very complex organizations. You've built strategies across global firms like BMO and BlackBerry. What are some of the key lessons in aligning leadership and operationalizing equity at scale?
Alignment is everything. And so when working with global organizations, and I've worked with numerous in my capacity at Empowered EDI as well, we focus on not just launching programs. We're focusing on embedding accountability into leadership expectations and operational goals. And that's not quotas, right? Instead, what we're looking at is, how are we ensuring that we are, in fact, being fair? So the performance rating example, if we see that there's gaps, what are we doing to make sure that those gaps are not rooted in bias? And how are we holding ourselves accountable to make sure that our decisions are evidence-based? For example, managers need to provide objective evidence. They need to provide, you know, what was observed, what was the impact, what is the feedback that they would provide for an employee to do better in a concrete fashion, not just, you know, do better next year, but specifically what needs to be done better. Yeah. Holding managers accountable. You cannot submit your performance feedback until you meet these criteria. That helps to reinforce the kind of behaviors that we want to see. Organizationally, though, companies need to get clear on what does equity mean for them? You know, why is this important to their vision, to their mission, to their values? I think it should be a priority for every company. But to be honest with you, there are many companies that don't care about it. They don't care about ethics. They don't necessarily want to prioritize fairness. If that's the case, be honest about that. If this is not the thing that you want to work on and make central to the way that you operate, let your people know so that they can make an informed decision about if they want to work for you or not. But for those companies that do care about this, what is your why? How does this link to your vision? We need leaders to be important and to be committed. And then we need systems that are going to reinforce those behaviors. So systems could be things like policies. One example, an organization I'm working with right now, they have a learning and development policy that requires that employees have to have been with the organization for more than a year, that they never have been reorganized within their organization, and that they've exceeded performance expectations in order for them to get access to a training program. So you can imagine many of our teams have been reorganized in the last couple of years, you know, maybe you've been moved under a new umbrella, a new department. If that happens, you don't get training. That's not fair. Another organization I'm working with, they have benefits that terminate once somebody reaches 65 years old or if they go on parental leave. So if you're off on parental leave and you acquire an injury or a disability, you do not have access to massage therapy, for example, or psychological services. So when we talk about systems that reinforce behaviors, what we're talking about are things like this, policies and procedures that make sure that people are, quite frankly, treated fairly, right? That there's not these barriers that would get in the way of someone accessing the support, the care, the development opportunities that they deserve.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I want to think about, like, especially because you've done now so much work, right? You mentioned 2 decades, I believe, right? 2 decades within the field, and looking at now into the future, what does this landscape look like in terms of shifts and trends that you're seeing and how companies are approaching equity today, right? And where do you think the field is heading next?
The companies that have deprioritized equity, diversity, and inclusion were often the ones that were looking at this as a program. They were the ones who were throwing money at doing training and creating beautiful glossy brochures about their strategy, but were not embedding this into their systems, their policies, their practices, and how they make decisions. So where I see the future of this work is that the companies that are going to continue on are going to be doing this in a way that is more embedded, more systemic, and more about capability building than checklists. And to be honest with you, I think that that work is going to be incredibly impactful. So I'm excited about the future of this work. However, I do think that we have a long road to get there because there is a lot of resistance and misunderstanding around this work today. A lot of haters who just, they hear the word DEI or EDI and immediately they are a naysayer. So I think as a professional in this space, we have to do more to communicate, give examples. Like, this is actually what the work is. There's no hidden agenda. We're not hiring people who aren't qualified. We're making sure that we're clear on what qualifications mean.
Yeah, I actually want to do a follow-up question to that, because one thing I'm curious from your perspective is around, where does AI fit into the DEI conversation? Like, could AI be embedded to help support that? What are your thoughts around that?
I love using AI as a way of challenging my perspective. So, for example, I will create a recommendation or come up with a perspective or a conclusion on something, and then I will put it into ChatGPT and say, I want you to give me counter arguments. What am I missing? What would a person from a different perspective say to this? And what I've really valued is that it gives me an opportunity to kind of test my thinking in a safe space where sometimes it feels scary to do that. Yeah. In real life with people, especially right now, people are hard pressed to have difficult conversations with one another. And so I think AI can really help us to get out of our ideological echo chambers and help us to see things from different perspectives. Where I'm a bit nervous, though, is many companies are looking to use AI technology in their recruitment, performance management, talent management practices. I caution that because oftentimes what happens, you've heard this, garbage in, garbage out. So if, for example, AI is taking a look at, okay, what are the attributes or the skills of people who work in this company today who are top performers? Let's just say they're creating a composite profile of who that person is. Mm-hmm. And then they use that to say, anybody coming into this company is going to be assessed against this criteria. We're going to give them a quiz. We're going to give them a test. And we're going to measure how well they do on each of these different dimensions. What they're looking to do is match. They're looking to see who is similar to who's already in this company and making decisions to select out people who might bring different perspectives, strengths, experiences. It might sound nice on the surface because, you know, wow, we're going to have a group of people who are cohesive. They might agree a lot. It's going to feel comfortable. It might feel fun, like you're working with friends. But I can tell you that company is not going to perform in the long run because people who think alike are not going to innovate. You need different experiences, perspectives, backgrounds, skill sets in order for us to come up with ideas that are new and different. So I would caution us when we're thinking about using AI in any sort of decision-making about people to ensure that the ways in which the AI are applied is not perpetuating bias or causing us to favor people who are quite similar already to the composition of our workforce.
Yeah, it's almost like before you implement AI, do a bit of a review, right, to make sure your current practices are not already biased, to your point. And then feel free at that point to afterwards, after you've done some of the kind of the heavy lifting, rather than just perpetuating, like you said, the bias that may exist. So we're towards the tail end of our conversation, Michelle. I can't believe, you know, it's already, you know, time has flown so quickly. I'd like to end by asking you, if you were to give yourself, your younger self, maybe your 20-something self, a piece of advice, what would it be?
There's this saying that what you resist persists. And that for me has been just such a big part of my own work, understanding that you can't outrun trauma. You can't just put it on a shelf and decide that you're going to deal with it another day. These things have a way of catching up with you. So candidly, I'm somebody who's experienced a lot of complex trauma through my life, both in terms of, you know, physical abuse, growing up, father who has a history of incarceration and mental health challenges, as well as I'm a sexual abuse survivor. And the way I coped with that my entire life was by being productive. So in high school, I worked over 40 hours a week. 7 days a week. When I was in university, I worked over 60 hours a week while maintaining a stellar GPA and being on scholarship. And the same thing, you know, my graduate school, I did it half the time while working at BlackBerry. I've always been somebody who is a huge achiever. And as I've gotten older, I've realized that while that on the face of it is such a strength because, you know, I've done a lot, it has been a coping strategy for me. It's been a way that I've been able to kind of tune out the voice in my head that something's not okay. I would just busy myself and just put it away, put it on a shelf. Well, I can tell you in my 30s, it all came just flooding in. And I really needed to take the time to be with my thoughts and to find the right supports to enable me to unpack everything that had happened. That's going to look different for everybody. For me, therapy has been huge. It took me a really long time to find a therapist that was supportive of what I needed. But when I did, it opened up a lot of awareness for me, but also other pieces. So physical activity, as I talked about before, mindfulness and meditation, journaling. I do a lot of reading, not only EDI reading, but I do read a lot just about mindfulness, spirituality, other people's experiences with trauma. I had to take the time to get real with myself about what I had been through and how it has caused me to be on this path of running. It materialized at one point with not only complex PTSD, depression, and anxiety, and I was at my wit's end. You know, in my 30s, I was in a place of contemplating suicide because I just felt like I could never be happy. I would never be enough. No matter how much I achieved on the outside, I felt inferior. I felt hopeless on the inside. And so I would say for anyone who, I mean, we all have stuff, right? No matter who you are, there's something in your past that's been hard. The loss of a loved one, for example. Feel your feelings, go inward, allow yourself to process it, to grieve, to get the support that you need. Because by going there, by allowing yourself to be present, to slow down with it, you're going to come out stronger and wiser. And I would add, you're going to have so much more capacity for other people's experiences too. You're going to be more compassionate. You're going to be more open-minded. You are going to be somebody who can hold space for others and deal with the depth of their experiences because you have had that experience yourself, or you yourself have allowed yourself to heal. So what you resist, persist.
Yeah.
Deal with the heavy stuff, you know, don't continue to run and run and run.
First off, I just want to say, like, thank you so much for sharing that very vulnerable piece of your life. Thank you for sharing that with the audience. And I just feel like I have even a higher level of respect for you now. And I want us to meet for coffee and like have a talk further, you know, without the podcast on, right? And get to know you even more. Like, you're brave, you're caring and extremely empathetic, and the work you do is profound. So thank you so much for being on the Employee Wellbeing Council's Wellbeing Ignites Wellbeing podcast.
Likewise, Tyagi. I just so admire what you're doing here. And thank you to all of your listeners for caring about people and caring about people's well-being. It makes a difference. We need more leaders, more coworkers who bring this kind of humanity and empathy to the world of work. So thank you all.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Wellbeing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.